Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us now, as they do every week, is our roundtable, Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners, and Richard Alafia of the Teal Group Consultancy. Gentlemen, always great to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Vago. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Vago.
TGI Sunday, Vago.
Thanks very much. And before we get started, Leonardo DRS sponsors our global coverage, Northrop Grumman, our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall, Fincantieri, Marinette Marine, our naval coverage, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, our coverage of strategy, and Beretta USA, our land warfare coverage. Ron, unfortunately, COVID fatalities continue to increase now in the United States, getting closer to a 500,000 Americans who've lost their lives on this. Vaccinations are increasing, as we've discussed, UK doing a good job on it, whereas Europe still more than somewhat stalled. Talk to us a little bit about how the sector overall performed on the street last week.
Yeah, so if you look at the S&P on the week, the S&P was up a little over 1%. And there was a bit of a dispersion, in the group. We had a couple of companies report this week. Our Canadian coverage, Bombardier, CAE, TransDigm, U.S. company that does a lot of aftermarket work. If you look across the group, the best performer of the week actually was Embraer. Embraer was up about 6.5%. Boeing was up in line with the market. And then the defense guys were just a smidge under the market, right? So they were essentially flat on a week where the market was up about 1%. So, and that's what we've seen now, broadly speaking, for the last couple of weeks. I would take the Embraer move as a sense that there's maybe a little bit more risk on. Investors maybe looking at emerging markets, getting a little more comfortable with that. If you look at oil closed the week at about $60. And on the yield curve, we didn't see much change, but it's still, the 10 years around 1.2%, the 30 years 2%. So, we're in a steepening yield curve environment, but by any stretch of the imagination, it's not very steep.
And, there were some veteran investors, Jim Rogers, others, folks talking about Buffett. Everybody's talking about fundamentals. Younger investors keep going like, boomers, you guys keep talking about a cooling market. At the end of the day, what are you hearing from investors in terms of what the outlook is from a fundamental standpoint, since that has become kind of a growing storyline, right? Folks are like, hey, you got to get out of the market because it's going to crash. And then other people saying like, let it rip. Stuff's going great.
Yeah, well, that's what makes a market, right? I mean, you need two sides to a trade. I would say, broadly, particularly on aerospace and defense, one of the questions on commercial is how much of a recovery is already discounted in the stocks, right? Because stocks in general are supposed to, discount, future cash flows. So how much of that's discounted in? And I would say the consensus view is actually a fair amount is, honestly. And then on defense, I think it's a little bit more of the opposite, where, defense, if you look at its valuations relative to the market, they're almost at all-time lows. I mean, the defense is trading at 50 to 60% of the market multiple. And I think investors now are kind of looking at defense names and they're kind of dusty sitting in the corner. They're starting to dust them off and say, hey, you know what, actually, this might not be so bad. So there might be a little bit of a rotation going on, not a lot, but a little bit. But I think that's where investors' heads are.
And some of the airline stocks did get caught up in that options GameStop wave that we saw a couple of weeks ago. And obviously there are going to be hearings up on Capitol Hill next week on that.
On that front, Margo, I just might add, GameStop's back down to 50, right? So we went from 20 to 350 back down to 50. So, the question always, and I always bring this up, fundamentals eventually do matter, right? And then I think the debate here was something like GameStop, which I do not cover and I don't know much about, was 20 the right level or is 50 the right level? But I think, across the board, the consensus view is 350 was not the right level.
It did go north of 400 at one point, but the fundamental issue was, right, how the hedge funds, right? I mean, Citadel owns Robinhood. Robinhood was a key part of this from an option standpoint, and then they just stopped trading, right? So you couldn't buy shares. All you could do was sell shares, right? So there is a little bit of a sense in some of the folks in the GameStop community and certainly the Reddit boards that, you know, the market behaved, you know, potentially criminally at the end of the day to get everybody out of this, because all of a sudden this exposed the short positions of major hedge funds and brought them down to their knees, right? I mean, Melvin Capital being one of them, and certainly going to be interesting to hear from everybody next week. Although that's not the first time that a stock has not traded on fundamentals. I think we can agree. Sash, you're still in lockdown. The British government has 4 weeks into it, I think. British government last week instituted some very, very tough regulations for people coming in and out of the country. The question I've got from all of you is, you know, we're all vaccine fundamentalists. Richard, I know that you're somewhat more bullish about how soon we rebound. But Europe doesn't have vaccinations. And there's increasingly concern, even from public health officials, that actually we will never be over fully coronavirus, that we may need more masks, more physical distancing, and that there may be capacity limits in everything that we do, right? So this notion that there'll be we'll get back to normal may be actually very different. Sash, start us off, right? I mean, what's your sense, your thinking, your estimates, especially as you go into what is a 14-day quarantine period if you want to come into the United Kingdom?
Yeah, I mean, look, well, actually, we're 7 weeks into lockdown now. There is a suggestion that we will very slowly start lifting it. For example, that children might go back to school in about a month's time, and then certain other issues might be loosened by then. But it's been a very, very long and uncomfortable lockdown. You're absolutely right. The debate this week here in Europe has been about travel restrictions. So the UK now, it's not just 14-day quarantine, but if you're coming from a list of about 30 countries, you're going to have to go into a hotel, pay on your own, on your own check for a 14-day stay. You don't even get out early if you take a test and so forth. And that feels very draconian. And the clear objective of the government is to try to deter people from traveling, which is, I think, all of our worst nightmares, frankly. And the problem, and I, you know, Europe is clearly the worst affected by coronavirus in terms of, overall number of cases and certainly number of deaths per thousand or million of population. European countries are all reacting in slightly different ways. So the lockdown rules are different in every country. They change at totally different times. But net, compared to where we were, let's say, in December, the various controls on travel, the controls on gatherings and so forth are probably stricter now than they were 2 months ago. And it's quite hard at the moment to see how they're going to loosen up. Now, it may be that the darkest hour is just before the dawn, and that, you know, come May and June, cases are down massively. We have nice sunny weather, because it does occur in Europe. Well, Europe certainly not necessarily in the UK. And that governments just say, okay, everybody, you went through the bad times with us and you're all great now, you know, enjoy the summer. I wouldn't be so sure. I think that the governments have discovered that they have to control stuff, that they can control stuff. Actually, there's a very, very high degree of public support for it. Protests against the lockdowns have been very limited. Netherlands has been an astonishing example. France, but then the French protest against everything that their government does. But other countries in Europe, definitely not. It's a fascinating debate. It does not feel comfortable for me as an aerospace analyst, because I think the risk is on the downside. And if I look at the comments that, let's say, Airbus made at the beginning of this year about their production rates and wanting to start raising rates in the third quarter, and I then look at how the traffic stats have deteriorated in the last 4 weeks, and I look at how the various European governments have been putting restrictions on, not lifting them, I can't help feeling that when Airbus report on the 18th, so, you know, this Thursday, I think they're just going to be a bit more cautious than they otherwise would have been.
Richard, your sense as somebody who's been a bit on a bull on how quickly we rebound?
Still bullish, but I understand the caution. I mean, the name of the game from the start has always been to bridge the gap between, well, the massive nosedive in traffic and the recovery in traffic. And when I say bridge the gap, it means keeping deliveries going, even though really in that valley, nobody really wants or needs a jet. So therefore, the timing of the start of that recovery is absolutely fundamental to people thinking about production rates and about financing those jets and continuing with the wonderfully generous finance packages that have allowed airlines to keep taking delivery of capacity they don't need. I understand that, but still, yes, there is more risk on the downside, of course. But we're talking about whether the recovery begins in earnest in June, July, August, September. We're still seeing it in sight. It still starts to happen this year. Yes, there is the possibility of, another AstraZeneca combined with South Africa mutation with inability to control. And yes, governments will get more involved. But nevertheless, look, traffic has recovered somewhat. We're at 50% or something like that. And it's going to get a lot better as soon as this situation gets under control. I'm just a matter of time.
Ron? Any change in your estimates?
No, I mean, our underlying estimates are the same, that we get back to 2019 air traffic levels some point in 2023. Now, that said, if indeed things play out differently, okay, so differently being there's more mutations or whatever, you pick your scenario and it's a risk, downside risk scenario. I ultimately think, and I think I probably fall in Richard's camp more on this, that we'll A, learn how to live better with it, and B, we'll innovate our way out of it, that ultimately, necessity is the mother of invention, and we'll figure it out. So I think it's ultimately a matter of time. So if that does happen, okay, so maybe we get back to 2019 air traffic levels in 24, maybe it's 25. Now that the industry has to adjust to that, and that's not our base case, but I do think, that the world will travel again, and we'll figure out how to deal with it. And I don't want to belittle the fact that we've been dealing with this for, over a year, but it's only been a year and it's a global pandemic and it's very complicated and things have gone in some ways the right way, in some ways not, but in some ways they have. So I guess I'm not as, how can I say, scared that it's going to fundamentally change things medium term in a negative way.
Let's shift gears. Since its founding, Southwest Airlines has been an all Boeing airline operating 737s, except for a couple of years when they operated the Trijet 727. Now the Dallas-based airline is interested in A220-300s, the C-series jet. There was originally by Bombardier, right? Absolutely terrific product. Boeing and the Trump administration were seeking to punish the development of that airplane, and ultimately it ended up going into Airbus's hands, right? Driven into Airbus's hands. And now Airbus has a formidable product in its arsenal that already includes the A321neo. That's a game changer. Sash, start us off. How important a development is this that Southwest is looking at Airbus jets?
Phenomenally. Southwest is one of the last, I think, previously thought of as almost uncrackable Boeing customers, and therefore targets for Airbus. You get the seal from Southwest and you've got it made. And it's hard to see that not as being game over for Boeing if they lose Southwest. And Airbus probably know that, and Boeing certainly do. It would also, which I think is at least important, be incredibly important for the A220. The A220 commercially has moved in fits and starts. It didn't work under Bombardier's management, and particularly with Bombardier's lack of financing and heft overall. Airbus has done pretty well, selling it to Delta, JetBlue, Air France, KLM, but the orders have come in lumps, and then it goes very, very quiet again. It's got an incredibly narrow customer base, albeit, 3-4 high-quality airlines there. Once you've got Southwest on board, that tells every other airline that this is an aircraft that they can look at for their 737 replacement requirements with complete and utter confidence. And given that, that cannot be the most original comment that's ever been made about this, Everybody, Boeing, Airbus, Southwest knows that. And it's going to be, you know, the pricing is going to be, and the commercial issues are going to be astonishing.
Richard, your sense on the implications here, since I know you talk to some of these guys on a relatively frequent basis.
Not quite as dire as I think Sash says. I mean, first of all, these rumors have been around for a very long time. Second of all, Max, you know, it's a good program. When it gets going again, I think it'll be fine, but it's also the last 737. Eventually, after half a century, Southwest needs to think about what it does next. And the A220 is as good a place to start. Significance, yeah, you know, it's going to have to happen sooner or later. They're going to have to break with the 737. Now, there is this problem, you know, they're really the only customer for the 737 MAX 7. And if they go with the A220-300, I can't imagine why they would want any of the MAX 7s. So that kind of means, well, another variant where we're another part of the single aisle waterfront where Boeing really can't compete. It's having a hard time with the MAX 9 and 10 against the 321. And now the MAX 7, its only customer, could just go away. Again, the MAX will be a good production program, but it really will just come down to the MAX 8 eventually. And that's an awkward place to be. I'd also remind people that's where McDonnell Douglas ended. It had all kinds of grand plans for the MD-90, and -10, -30, -40, -turbo LX, whatever else. And the only thing it built was the -30. So you got to be careful about being marginalized in the single aisle department. But from Southwest, you know, look, they also want to compete people against each other. And of course, they're eager to get the best deal they can. So I'm not so sure there's all that much new going on here.
Ron, do you see this as part of sort of the market driving Boeing into a new airplane, right? A little bit like American Airlines drove the development of the MAX, given that the A321 was picking up at the time?
Yes and no, right? So I think, in fact, I'll agree with both Sash and Richard in that I think Richard's point is very important. In the past, Southwest has looked at, if you guys remember, the Fairchild Journey 728, the E1 190, the E2 190, and they've looked at other Airbus variants in the past. So, you know, Southwest has been very public about when they've looked at other equipment. So from that point of view, this is not new. However, if the decision does go that they go with the 220 over the 737, 7 MAX, Sash is 100% right. I mean, that's a big blow to the program, right? And you know, per Richard's comments, then you're just left with the MAX 8. And that's, you know, that's not ideal to you just have the one, you know, the one airplane that's very good at what it does, but it, you know, your biggest competitor then has a much broader coverage of the market with a lot of market support behind it. Does it force Boeing to do another plane? I don't see how. I mean, you know what I mean? You can't shrink. I mean, if the 7 MAX doesn't work, short of another airframe itself, I don't know what they could do. They did have a solution at one point with Embraer, and I really don't see that coming back together. So no, and I don't think it does. I think in that case, it's just, they're just not in that part of the market, and that's just the way it goes.
Yeah, I mean, and the Embraer news was particularly devastating, right? I mean, I think that was, you know, the two companies have been moving closer together after Bombardier, right? It seemed like it was going to be something that would be important and fill out an important shortcoming. And then all of a sudden, right, short-sightedness is what I chalk it up to, Boeing.
Well, I think you just have to be on that one. There was a lot of bad blood generated on the Brazilian side, meaning I don't think everybody at Embraer, you know, candidly was on board with the deal in the first place. Right. They got into it reluctantly, and then to have Boeing walk out of it the way they did and blame them for it.
Correct.
It's a very proud company that's generally very up and up and very honest and very straightforward. So, you know, my sense is that the way that fell apart, it generated a ton of bad blood in San Jose de Campos.
It did. You know, I think we're all fans of Embraer, and it's a first order engineering company, right? And builds a really, really good product. Anyway, Bombardier, very quickly, Ron, since we're talking about Bombardier, I think it's important. Let's just give a quick recap and do some quick earnings work, because we still want to talk about one of the big, the biggest defense story, France, Germany, SCAF, and what all of that means. Give us a quick walkthrough on Bombardier. Bombardier and CAE reported, and I think that we have to have a moment of silence for the passing of Learjet, which started an important market and will be no more. Ron, take it away.
Yeah, so this week we had several companies report. I think, you know, the three bellwethers, if you will, were TransDigm with their aftermarket coverage. And, you know, their numbers were broadly kind of what people were expecting. CAE was the same thing. For those of you not familiar with CAE, you know, they're the one of the largest, if not the largest, flight simulator provider and pilot training and other simulation market provider. And their numbers were not great, but as expected, right? So Bombardier, the big thing there was the announcement that they're shutting down Lear. And of course, that's sad for any number of reasons, but for someone who's followed Bombardier for a long time, they just kind of ignored Lear, right? It's really kind of sad. I mean, if you had this franchise and this brand value, and you know, I think if you look at the numbers, there's something like 4,000 Learjets out there. So you right. potentially have this huge customer base, and it was a market that they just largely ignored. They had the failed Lear 85 that they were developing, and that didn't work. And then they just kind of ignored it. And you know, it's just really kind of sad to see a company with that, you know, that history, that lineage, to just sort of fade away.
Yeah, I mean, it is really baffling because the airplane is still at a size, right? I mean, everybody's been going up and up and up in the size of the planes, but Lear was actually in that reusable class of airplanes that gives you a whole different level of customer. And with a massive installed base like that, you would have thought that they would want to capitalize on that ultimately. Again, you know, part of the tragedy of watching Bombardier as, you know, managing its portfolios. Sash, Saab reported, and also you've been looking at what to expect from Airbus next week and Dassault the week after that. Quickly walk us through the universe, and if either you or Richard want to put any commentary on top of the demise of Lear, please feel free to do so.
I'll just start off with that and say that, you know, Lear aircraft were very, very high performance, or are very high performance aircraft. But actually, you know, this comes back to the fact that Embraer came in at that market segment and just designed cheaper, you know, more efficient, more modern designs, arguably, as has Textron. You know, the small, effectively, you know, US market 4 to 6 passenger aircraft, unless you need the astonishing performance of a Learjet, and most people don't, you were just getting the much more modern product from Textron and Embraer. Yeah, I mean, Saab, so, you know, switching to Europe, and I'd like to say we're switching to defense, but actually the Saab numbers were pretty poor. The shares were down 6%, down at one stage nearly 7%. And the real issue here was, you know, it was an okay end to the year, but it wasn't very exciting. It wasn't that good. They did a great job on cash. They got a lot of cash in from their customers. They did a great job on orders, including an order for another 2 GlobalEye airborne early warning aircraft from the United Arab Emirates. That takes them to 5. And our view is they're doing really well in terms of their exposure to the Swedish market and the Swedish defense budget going up 40% over the next 5 years. There aren't many defense budgets you can say that about. Problem is, they're just not making the profit that they should from the sales that they're doing. They're struggling to get to their 10% margins. And it was really hard to listen to them and expect and, you know, not see them sort of pushing the profit expectations out a bit. And the civil aerospace activities that they have that nobody ever looks at in the good times, but they're a big aerostructure supplier to Airbus and Boeing in particular, but also make air traffic management products. And those are all just doing dreadfully. And they said they have received cuts to offtake from, they always refer to them rather coyly as their 2 biggest aerostructures customers. So that's Airbus and Boeing, in case people missed that, every single month in the last 6 months. So what they've got is a big aerostructures capability, particularly at Linköping, which is just, you know, the tumbleweeds blowing around it, and it's costing them a ton of money. So, you know, they've got a lot going for them in terms of their radar technology, a lot going for them in terms of, you know, managing the Gripen contracts to particularly to Brazil, but not coming through to profits at the moment, and the market didn't like it at all. So I'm just switching now to Airbus and Dassault. Dassault actually, very quickly, results out in a couple of weeks' time, but we wrote a note on this week. Interesting thing there is they're seeing the same lousy bizjet market that arguably Bombardier saw with Learjet. Dassault is a bit like Learjet, that they are lacking a new product at the moment. They're waiting for the Falcon 6X, which should start sale of deliveries end of next year. Then they've got another Falcon behind that. But at the moment, production in 2021 will probably be the lowest since the early 90s, below 20 aircraft. So they become a marginal producer of large biz jets compared to Bombardier and Gulfstream up at the top end. And that's an astonishing story. We're going to talk about Rafale and sort of SCAF in a minute. But actually, I think our view is, by contrast, Rafale is likely to have perhaps its best year ever in terms of new orders in 2021. So what you've got is Falcon dragging things down, Rafale dragging it up again. Finally, Airbus. I think the most important thing for Airbus is, they had a very good end to the year in terms of deliveries. Airbus always does that, and they did it really well in December. That should be good for cash. And remember, Airbus went from 13 billion in net cash to a bit of net debt during last year. That shows where you have to start downturns with cash, because it flows out in civil aerospace company. Guidance for 2021 is going to be absolutely crucial to the share price this week.
Richard, your sense on all of that, and what your expectations? You and Ron want to get your sense on what you guys are expecting from Airbus next week.
Yeah, first of all, take a moment to gently dissent from Sasha's view of the business jet market. It's doing pretty well, especially compared to jetliners. There's actually almost no comparison. You've got upwards numbers coming from Textron. Bombardier, they've got issues with the financials, but in terms of deliveries, just fine. And as Ron points out, Gulfstream, only profitable aircraft company in the world last year, with really strong guidance for this year too. Obviously, you've got two problems. Learjet was kind of, for all the reasons we described, just and Ron described, just marginalized by lack of product. And so they're marginalized by not having anything that's at the top end, where Gulfstream and Bombardier are doing just great. So yes, the 6X will help, followed presumably by the launch of something new. We're hearing rumors of, 9X have for some time. But this is isolated to Dassault. And as Ash has pointed out, it's a good thing their defense side is doing just great. There's always been this kind of counter-cyclical attitude, approach the company has taken. I remember many years ago, by the way, when the military side was in the ascendant and Falcons were marginal, this is the mid-90s, I was given a tote bag that said, every Dassault business jet has a little brother in the military or something like that. And right. It was sort of this, back and forth in terms of the civil and military side. But, I guess the message is that the broader business jet market is heading up this year, not down.
And Airbus.
Yeah, exactly what Saz says. We'll see. It's really just a question of whether the people who pay for these jets, the financiers, are going to stay in the game and are going to say, hey, when the time comes, we're going to have a really strong comeback, especially in domestic markets, and we want that capacity in place. There are some smart people out there who've said, if anything, we could be undersupplied in 2023. So will they, keep the game going? And will airlines be able to be willing to tolerate idle capacity? Will financiers be willing to occasionally grant the odd lease holiday and whatever else? Will they keep it going? And that's absolutely key, as Sash says, to Airbus's results this year.
Ron, before we transition to talk about SCAF, France, Germany, Rafale, as well as the Anglo-Italian-Swedish Tempest program, very quickly, 737 MAX, right? United put it back in service, and the company's APU joint venture with French engine maker Safran appears to have collapsed. Anything you want to say about whether on the business jet front, whether on the Airbus forward look, or on any of this other commercial drips and drabs before we move on?
Yeah, so I'd say real quickly on business jets, Richard points out that they've done quite well in comparison to their large commercial brethren. That being said, I think probably the only real controversy there is we haven't seen in private aviation the demand being driven by business travel. It's really been personal leisure, whatever you want to call it. And the real question becomes, and that you could debate it either way, is when things really start to move with the, you know, the airlines, will the leisure component that picked up because of COVID, will it stick? You know, will it stay there or not? I think that's the biggest debate, and you can kind of go either way. I mean, you hear a lot of people say, once you fly private, you always fly private, but it's also orders of magnitude more expensive than, you know, flying on an airline. So I think that's one key point. The other point on Airbus, for better or for worse, because of the dynamic around the 737 MAX, Boeing is now the swing producer. If demand for narrow bodies wanes, Boeing will get hit by that before Airbus will, just because of how things have been structured because of all the delays on the MAX. And that's just the reality now. So, if we get into an environment where, we're short narrow body jets in 2023, that's good for everybody. If we get into an environment where there's too many narrow body jets floating around for whatever reason, that's probably worse for Boeing than it is for Airbus because of that dynamic.
I'm going to change gears, and we're going to talk about the SCAF and Tempest program now. Sash, France and Germany have pressed ahead with development of SCAF, their new sixth-generation aircraft, with a contract to build some demonstrators. That's going to be around the Rafale. But these talks have not gone well. Richard, I know you're going to claim gloating rights because it was 3 years ago that you said that this program was going to be doomed, in part because of different export views from the French side, which has been successful with the Rafale, whereas the Germans have been far more restrictive in terms of who they want stuff exported to. At the same time, the Anglo-Italian Swedish Tempest program really is forging ahead. Sash, give us a sense on where we are on SCAF. What does it all mean? And whether or not France ultimately will have to have a plan B, and the Germans actually end up in Tempest and the French end up developing a jet on their own, which is pretty much what they would rather do anyway.
We need an hour for most of that, but I'll try to keep it to a few minutes. There's a very, there's one of the many elements of the Franco-German relationship, which is as close as any two countries that I can think of, is there's a Franco-German Defense and Security Council meets twice a year. Most of the time, it is extremely cordial, but it's all about increasing the relationship across a multiple of touch points. It met last weekend. The primary area that President Macron and Chancellor Merkel talked about was SCAF, or FCAS, if you're German, the Future Combat Air System. And if you read the French press, and the French press is normally very, very well briefed by the Élysée, it was a jaw-droppingly toxic meeting. I've spoken to a number of industrialists since then, and some of them are still in shock, nearly a week later. The French are accusing the Germans of basically trying to steal their technology, trying to make sure that any technology that goes into SCAF is pooled and can then be used by both countries and both companies. And that tends to mean, from the French side, Dassault puts technology in, and Airbus Defence and Space, which they see as being a German company, takes it out again. It's been astonishing the way that they've done this. I think the most interesting bit of feedback from this meeting actually was the headline from Tribune, one of the French broadsheet newspapers. And the headline was, and I'll translate for all of our readers, we should not sign a bad deal. It's worse than not signing at all. If you remember, Theresa May, the late, probably not very lamented British Prime Minister, said about Brexit, no deal is better than a bad deal. And this has been echoed by the French press and hence the French political system over SCAF. That's remarkable. And I think SCAF is crumbling at the moment, unless there are some big concessions made primarily by Germany, but also by France on this. And I'm not sure I can see that. By contrast, Tempest, which is a very, very quiet program, because it's a in as much as anything defense can be, a depoliticized program. It's being done at the technical level. The chief executive of Saab, Mikael Johansson, said this week at the Saab results, looking at the Tempest collaboration with the UK and now with Italy, we will start concept definition phase in April, and we'll then start to build demonstrators. this program is on rails. It's, you know, it's happening. And once they start talking about building demonstrators, note the plural, that gives the Tempest program a you know, it's ground truth. And it gets much, much harder then to cancel than when it's just a PowerPoint process. So I think Tempest is actually doing astonishingly well at the moment, but the Franco-German relationship is in a really bad way. And that's a remarkable thing to see.
Richard, do you see this program as doomed?
You know, since it began, it's kind of like watching a cow rumble across a minefield. You know, it's just a matter of time. It's just not going to make it. Spoiler alert. So I don't care whether it's the next step or the step beyond that. That cow's getting blown up. I'm sorry. From my standpoint, the really interesting question is what kind of terms and conditions the UK is going to offer Germany to join Tempest? And, you know, are they going to be, well, the current situation with UK continental relations over vaccines doesn't exactly encourage one. But when the time comes to negotiate their entrance, are they going to say, fine, you can do the LP compressor and a wing fin? Or are they going to say, yeah, you know, you've always been one third of a European program and here's your third? If I were them, I would be generous because that's the alignment that has always happened historically. Everybody except for France, and then France on their own, you know, a Franco-French joint venture. That outcome is basically inevitable. It's just a question of whether the UK is going to wisely give the Germans reasonably generous terms.
Well, Andy Pastor of the Wall Street Journal did a thoughtful piece, you know, sort of bringing us up to speed on the sort of unmanned revolution and where the United States military wants to go. Obviously, a huge amount of investment in artificial intelligence and machine learning and a lot of drone systems, right? Loyal Wingman, R2-D2, and you name it. Anything interesting that you saw in there, Richard, that's new?
Not really. I think a lot of it, you know, has sort of been out there for some time, and new exciting technologies, or I should say the combination of new exciting technologies and the emergence of doctrine appropriate to leverage those exciting technologies and whatever else, is always sort of 5 or 10 years away. And it's 5 or 10 years away now. It was 5 or 10 years away 5 or 10 years ago. And there's a very good chance that in 5 or 10 years, it'll be 5 or 10 years away. You know, the individual technologies are maturing. That's good. And one day there will be a confluence, but, you know, putting them all together and coming up with, again, you know, doctrine, mature systems, and whatever else, as well as interface with existing force structure, that's kind of a 5 or 10 years away story and will be for some time.
All right, guys. Thanks so very much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Have a great week and looking forward to having you back on again next week. Thanks a lot and happy Valentine's Day to everybody.
Thanks, Vago. Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure, Vago.
Thank you very much, Vago, and happy Valentine's Day to you and yours.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.